KQED.
Good morning from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. This morning, a look at a new approach to measuring how well California is doing in educating its children. The new Quality Count survey for 2007 puts California 34th in the nation in a chance for success index. That index uses not just test results from various grade levels, but income of the parents and their education and how soon kids get to school as indicators of how well a child will succeed. Is the new survey telling us something we don't know? Stick around and you can join us. That's on Forum starting right after the news from National Public Radio. Good morning. Welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels. Michael Krasny is away. It's hard to tell if it's good news or bad news, but according to a new survey, California ranks 34th in the nation in chance for success for its children. A new survey conducted by a nonprofit called Editorial Projects in Education Research Center compares a large number of factors in ranking students and evaluating how likely they are to succeed. Among those indicators are the parents' income, whether the parents went to college, how soon the child started school. California, it seems, has a problem because so many children don't speak English or their parents don't to begin with. This hour, a look at the new survey, but also a look at the value of such studies. Do they actually help our kids learn? With us to talk about all that are Christopher Swanson, the director of the Editorial Projects in Education Research Center. The nonprofit publishes Education Week magazine and developed the recently released Chance for Success Index. He joins us from Bethesda, Maryland. Good morning to you, Christopher Swanson.
Good morning, Spencer.
Michael Kirst is with us, Professor Emeritus of Education at Stanford University, still doing research there, and former president, I believe, of the Board of Education in California. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Deborah Santiago, Vice President for Policy and Research at Excellencia in Education. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Deborah Santiago.
Good morning.
And Steve Levy, who's the Director of the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy. He joins us from Napa, California. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Spencer.
Okay. Well, let's start with a little summary of the report and what it actually says. I mean, right off the top, it looks like, yeah, if your parents are doing well, you're likely to do well, too. That seems a little obvious. I'm sure the report says more than that. Christopher Swanson, tell us about the report.
All right. This is our Quality Counts report. This is the 11th installment annual report. For the first 10 years of the report, actually, we had a fairly narrow focus on K-12 education, elementary and secondary issues. And we tracked state education policy as well as looking at student achievement over the years. Coming into what's now the second decade of the report, you know, we took stock to think about what type of direction we wanted to push forward in. And we decided this year to, and it's a transition into a new framework a little bit, we're taking a view of education and through a wider lens, looking at the way education plays out throughout a person's lifetime, whether that's early childhood during the formal schooling years or later on into adulthood.
Is there anything in the results of this report that completely surprised you?
You know, there's always some things that are surprising and some things that aren't. The main focus of our report is our Chance for Success indicator, which is our way of kind of wrapping together these lifetime education ideas. You know, and in that indicator, we look at a series of 13 different measures, and they, you know, track education, you know, throughout the life stage. And in the early years, what's really important in the way we think about education is through family income and socioeconomic status, which provides the foundations for learning once the kids do get to school. During the schooling years, we look at kind of early education participation and then hard test score indicators during the elementary and secondary years, high school graduation, going on to college. And then once you hit adulthood, the real question with education is what can you do with your education? You know, can you take a good education and make good on it in the labor market? So we look at a variety of economic outcomes. You know, and
what do you mean a variety of economic, like how much money somebody makes?
No, that's part of it. And so, you know, we have a 50-state focus here, so we look at state averages, and we look, for example, at the level of education of the adult workforce, which is a good indication of economic opportunities and the labor force in general. But we also look at annual income levels and steady employment rates as well.
So back to my other question, yep. What surprised you?
Yeah, you know, we knew for sure that there would be differences from state to state, but one of the things that did surprise us is just how big those differences could be. You know, if you take the top-ranked and the bottom-ranked state and compare them, so Virginia is a top-ranked state, and New Mexico is a bottom-ranked state, on our index, you know, you can basically get 1 or 2 points plus or minus for each of these indicators. And when you look at Virginia versus New Mexico, there's a 45-point difference, you know, separating those two states.
So what does that essentially mean? That means that a child growing up in New Mexico has a much worse chance of succeeding in life than somebody growing up in Virginia?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, what's really, where you really appreciate this is if you lay out each indicator step by step and count points, you know, from the early childhood indicators into adulthood. At each stage of life, if you look at a state like Virginia or another top-ranked state, you see that students get off to a good start when they're young kids. And so, you know, socioeconomically, they're pretty well off.
Their parents speak English.
Parents speak English. Parents have steady income. Right, exactly. You know, and so that's, you know, they continue to step forward along what we can think of as a pathway toward successful prospects. During the schooling years, Virginia schools fare, you know, very well compared to, you know, the typical state. So they're above the national average. So they keep on stepping forward there. And then once you get out of school and you look around at the labor market to see if there's good opportunities and, if, you know, the labor force is well-educated, Virginia fares very well again, too. So you just continue to step forward. It's the exact opposite in, say, New Mexico or other low-ranked states where children start off life with significant disadvantages on average. It could be language. It could be unsteady employment. It could be low income levels. And then once you get to school, the schools are underperforming compared to the national average. So you continue the downward slide. And then finally, to add insult to injury, basically, when you look at the prospects for an adult with a good education in the state, they're not very good. Education levels among working adults in New Mexico are below the national average. Income levels are low. Rates of stay employment are low. You know, and so you can see a real divergence of the path that the states that are doing well and the states that are not doing well take.
All right, let's go to Michael Kirst for a second, Professor Emeritus of Education at Stanford. You've been in California almost all your working life. What is the 30? California ranked 34th. Now you would think you'd throw up your hands and say, "Wow, this big state, this huge economic engine, is 34th in the nation. What is wrong? What is wrong, or is anything wrong?"
Well, let me just comment first on the conceptual nature of this report. Most discussion in education policy focuses on one level: preschool education, K-12, higher ed, or the workforce. This report puts all the levels together and says it's all one interconnected system, and what really matters is what comes out at the end, not at any particular stage. So this is the first time that California has been ranked on all these segments and levels of education. And what it means is that we're going to be having trouble in the future, particularly, in having a highly skilled workforce that will earn good incomes. Indeed, I think we'll get into this later, I think the situation in the future is much worse than the report indicates because it doesn't do a lot of projection of our changing demographics.
What you seem to be saying, though, is as California becomes more Hispanic, it's sinking further down in the ranking. Is that fair?
That is one way. That is an important summary of this. The Latino growth in the state will drive the future in many ways. If you take the working age population, 25 to 64, it was 71% white in 1980, and in 2020 it'll be 39% white. Latino population was 16% of our working force in 1980, and it'll be 38% in 2020.
And yet everybody thinks of California as doing very well. It's got Silicon Valley. There's a pretty good income in this state. I don't know. Is there a disconnect here? Am I not getting something?
Well, the report shows that in higher education, we do reasonably well, and we do import a lot of people from other states, which is a very important way.
And other countries.
And other countries as well. Now, whether we can keep doing that with our housing costs, I think, is a real issue. Let me look at the flow of this for California. Our schools are dealing with a very difficult population of low parental income relative to the nation, high poverty rates, low numbers of high school graduates compared to other states. So we start with a tough hand. In preschool, we rank about at the national average. Our K-12 performance is really poor. We're down there in the bottom 10 states on math, reading, all academic indicators. The higher education part of the system is performing roughly at national averages, although I think that will deteriorate as the population changes and we have a growth in lower-income populations. And then the workforce indicators indicate we're doing reasonably well to other states. Part of that is the strong performance of the four-year colleges and the ability to import workforce.
Let me turn to Deborah Santiago, Vice President for Policy and Research at Excellencia in Education. She's in Washington, D.C. Ms. Santiago, what do you make of this report? Were you involved in it, by the way?
I was not involved in putting together the report, no. We had a similar piece that focused explicitly on California, looking at California policy options to accelerate Latino success in higher ed. But we definitely resonate with the study and the way it was approached. But from our perspective, I think we see this as an opportunity to act. And the value of this kind of education research is the ability to inform policy, because this current condition is not fait accompli. You know, we have the ability. If I added a little bit more information to the numbers of Latinos in California, we are also the youngest population, and that creates an opportunity for us to address education and this alignment issue, not just within our K-12 and higher education system, but within our entire environment. So we look at parental education, these other components in linguistic integration, and are able to do something about it. So I think the value of this from a policy perspective and the work that we do at Excellencia is to make sure that we inform people and then find ways to compel them to act so that this is not a done deal, and hopefully we can be better than where we are.
Well, tell me, you said this has policy implications and you want to help people improve situations. Mm-hmm. How does a report like this, what do you do to act on a report like this? You can't just say, well, we should improve education for Latino students. I mean, that's too glib.
that's a nice, lofty goal, but you do have to find ways to deconstruct it so you can have concrete, actionable items. What can we really do fundamentally?
So give me an example.
We're not just talking in platitudes.
Right, so give me an example.
For example, one of the suggestions we have in our report is, 50% of new births in California are to Latino parents. So why don't we get information about college access, college preparation opportunities at maternity wards? It's an existing structure. It doesn't necessarily take a lot of money. You can get people around that idea, and you can start getting information early on about what it's going to take. And we can, we have lots of other ones like that we, they're not exhaustive, but it's trying to get us to think in new ways and start getting us to action rather than just talking about these things.
Okay. Steve Levy, who is with the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy, you see a report like this, and I think you were to some extent involved in looking at it. What does it imply about California and especially the workforce?
It tells us that we have to work especially hard to train and educate a group of children who start with some disadvantages, but not, as Deborah said, insurmountable disadvantages, because these children are the workers who are going to replace the retiring baby boomers. The report was pretty clear that if you succeed educationally in California, we, as you said, have a good economy that produces lots of job opportunities at the middle level and at the higher level. We don't, as many of the people said, have a real alternative in terms of running this economy to succeeding in educating the children. We're not going to get hundreds of thousands of people from Iowa or Michigan or New York to come here like they did in the 50s or 60s. We're simply too expensive a state. So it lays out for us the very clear challenge of educating our children, who happen to be now primarily the children of immigrants or the grandchildren of immigrants, of educating those children so they fit into our economy. I could add to what Deborah said a couple of ideas. One is that their parents are now in the workforce. So whatever we can do in the way of expanding adult workforce training so that the parents of these children have opportunities to move up the career ladder and improve their income status will, according to Christopher's work, help their progress. And the thing that always comes to my mind in terms of policy, I read a study by the New America Media, which is in San Francisco, that said overwhelmingly the parents of Latino kids want their kids to succeed, want their kids to learn English, want their kids to go to college. I think California should be simply flooding the state with opportunities for adults and children to learn English in any way they can.
All right. Well, Steve, those are thought-provoking ideas, and I've got sort of two questions, and then we can bat them around with several of our guests. Number one, it sounds as though Steve is saying, here's the California economy. We need to educate kids to fit into that economy. We need to educate square pegs to fit into square holes. And in a way, that's a sort of a way of saying that we want a very homogeneous kind of society, and it might take away from some creativity. Perhaps, Christopher Swanson, you can talk a little bit about that idea of using the study to I don't know, almost a Big Brother kind of look at planning in the society.
Well, you know, I wouldn't put it in the terms of kind of Big Brother 1984 speak, but you know, I think we do see when we look at, you know, the profile in California, there is this disjuncture between kind of an economy right now that has some real opportunity and some strength and kind of what we see in kind of the next generation that we do see. California tends to, you know, the workforce is, you know, more educated than average, but the parents of young kids are less educated than average. So there's a real disjuncture here. And then we see some really spotty performance, especially in the elementary and secondary schools. And so the question is, exactly as you said, you know, are we educating the kids for the 21st century? And I don't think it's necessarily a lockstep solution that's needed. You know, a state as big and diverse as California, you know, that's not going to work. But I think we do need to figure out kind of where to target the efforts best. Somebody mentioned some language issues, you know, earlier. That may, you know, given California's demographics, that may be something that's more important in California than it would be elsewhere in the nation. But if we think about the types of work that we're going to need in the economy, you know, in the coming decades, you know, it's not the kind of work that's going to be necessarily heavily routinized and kind of, you know, chalk and drill in the schools is going to get it. You know, we're going to be needing people who can think on their feet, people who can solve problems, who can assimilate information, because the modern economy is going to require those kinds of skills. And, you know, I think the $64,000 question is about how do we take a state like California, you know, given where it is now and the challenges it faces in the future, make that happen. You know, and I think it is the intention of our report not to, you know, recommend answers because we don't presume to have them, but to, you know, call attention to these challenges, you know, and the challenges that a California faces or a Nevada or New York State or Florida. They're all a little bit different, and I think you can see that coming out in the data we present.
Michael Kirstie wanted to add to that.
Yes, I want to pose the issue here that 49% of our K-12 public school kids are Latino in California, 49%, and that's the largest group, and is growing by a percent a year as far as the eye can see. If you look at the percent of 18 to 24-year-olds in any form of college, community college, four-year college, you'll find that Asian Pacific Islanders are enrolled at a 60% rate, the white population's enrolled at a 43% rate, the black population at 32%, and the Latino at 22%. So you have a swing of 60% for Asians in college to 22% Latino. Now let me get to the solution. The Latinos.
Well, wait a minute. Before you get to the solution, how do you know that there's a question there? How do you are imposing the idea that it is better to go to college than not to go to college. That may not be a cultural goal of a lot of people in certain communities.
Well, as indicated by other studies, the Latino population overwhelmingly wants their students and their children to have a college education. Moreover, the point of the report is that when you look at the workforce needs in the state, this is has a large technical and education-based workforce.
Okay, I'll buy that.
So we're actually showing that the income in California will decline perhaps 11% between 2000 and 2020, the personal income of the whole workforce if we don't do something. So if you have this majority of public school students only going on to college at a fraction of the other rate, you have a problem. Now, let me talk about the solution here. 78% of the Latinos in California go on to the community colleges, and I want to focus on that as the key solution. Latino population here tends to go part-time to school, not full-time, and to go to the local community colleges. They are not well prepared, about 60% or more in remediation, and the completion rates are probably around 20%, either for a certificate for vocational education or for transfer to a four-year school or a two-year degree. So we need a massive improvement of community college quality and teaching for these students who are graduating from high school and going on to community college and not succeeding in overwhelming numbers. And that's going to erode the technical underbase of the workforce.
All right. Deborah Santiago, briefly, with Excellencia in Education. Is there a thought that if the society puts a lot more resources into educating undereducated Latino students, that that is going to take away from the middle-class students, the students who are doing better, and increase the exodus to private schools of those groups? Is there any that's obviously an important subject.
It is. And it's interesting that when we get to this point, it starts to become an either-or. Do we invest in this or in that? In part, I think that's the pragmatism of the financial situation we're in part in. But I worry that sometimes it creates this false dichotomy, thinking that we're separate entities, and by helping one, you harm another. And I think part of what this report, and I think what we've been talking about more broadly, is that there is an interconnectedness here, and that by assisting our low-income, underrepresented students, and in California, so many of them happen to be Latino, although not exclusively Latino, that somehow others that are better off but could use a little bit more help are going to suffer, and therefore we shouldn't do it, or that we go to the lowest common denominator. And I just think that from a policy perspective, that's not a healthy way to go, and it's not a useful way to strategize this, because at the end of the day, we are linked. The California economy as a state is going to be very dependent on these converging trends that we see of demographic growth, of economic, of educational attainment, and the lack thereof. You know, 9% of Latinos have a BA or more in California compared to 31% of all. And that has serious implications if we are going to be the majority of the workforce in California. So I think to pit one group against another and say somebody else is going to lose minimizes the fact that we all are going to lose if we as a state can't get to another level.
That's a good point. We're going to take a break in just a second, and we'll get back to some of these questions and to Steve Levy. We're talking about a new report dealing with California students and those across the nation. We're talking with Christopher Swanson at Editorial Projects in Education Research Center, Michael Kirst at Stanford, Deborah Santiago at Excellencia in Education, and Stephen Levy at the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy. You can join us after we come back from a break. I'm Spencer Michaels, and this is Forum from KQED. You're listening to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, and for Michael Krasny, we want you to call in and take part in our show on education. The phone number here is 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. Let me give out that toll-free number one more time, 866-733-6786. We're talking about a Chance for Success Index, a new study that came out that ranked California 34th in chances of success. We're talking with Christopher Swanson, who's director of the group that put the study together, Michael Kirst at Stanford, Deborah Santiago at Excellencia in Education, and Steve Levy, the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy. Steve, I want to ask, give you a chance to answer the question that I took from what you said, this idea of trying to fit people into our economy rather than let them do what they want and hope it works out. Is there any concern on your part? You keep talking about putting people, making them fit into the economy. It sounds like sort of slots.
Yeah, I really didn't intend to say that, so I apologize if that was the implication. I think the best way to look at this is we're trying to build California's next middle class. We can import rocket scientists. It's much harder to import the millions and millions of people that fill those middle-level jobs. I was trying to say the very simple thing. They're probably going to be mostly our children. And what the Ed Week report tells us is that many of those children start with some kind of disadvantage. So that's our challenge. There are lots of exciting middle-level jobs. I'm sure Deborah would agree. We don't have to have this image of either forcing people or that everybody has to be a PhD. It's much more kind of unromantic. But we have to get people through high school. We have to allow them some opportunities that they choose for some kind of post-secondary education. It doesn't have to be a four-year degree, because that's what middle-class jobs require now. And I guess at the end I'd say to all of the listeners, there's not much choice. We're talking about the future prosperity of our state, the people who are going to replace us when we retire, and we're either going to succeed as a state or fail as a state. And the report helps us understand that we start with a little behind. It's true that the kids in school, their parents are often recent immigrants or second generation immigrants. There may be language issues, and it helps us clarify what we need to do to create California's next middle class. And by the way, the people, the only people who are going to buy our homes when we retire or die or, you know, move on. Look at it that way.
I want to try one sort of cynical question. I'm not sure whether to ask Deborah or Christopher, but Deborah brought up the point of turning this into policy. I mean, we've seen so many studies over the years, not this one exactly, but other studies of education, and you wonder if they've really had much effect. What, can you anticipate that a study like this or this particular study, Christopher, will actually get to some lawmaker who will write a bill and will give more money to education if that's what it takes or something like that, or will this study sit on the shelf?
Well, you know, we're always optimistic that, you know, we don't gather too much dust.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we have some early indications that the states are paying attention to this seriously. You know, we've been asked to present at a couple state, you know, legislative committees or educational committees. And in fact, you know, I was on an interview last week where I was talking about the report, and they also had the state education chief from New Mexico on the program. And, you know, despite the fact that New Mexico is the lowest-ranked state and kind of fares poorly across the board, you know, I think we were hearing things from the state chief that, you know, we would have hoped to hear, that they're taking this information very seriously and they plan to, you know, take a cold, hard look at where they stand and use that as a starting point for going to the legislature, making an argument that we do need to better support our young kids and our school children and think about economy.
Okay, that's a good answer. Let's take a call from Catherine in Santa Clara. Hello, Catherine.
Yes, hello. My name is Catherine Sandoval, and I'm a law professor at Santa Clara University, and my grandfather was also a Mexican immigrant. So I wanted to make a couple of comments and ask a question. Mr. Michael, you made a couple of comments that suggested that part of the issue here was the values of the Latino community, and one of your other speakers pointed out that Latinos want their children to go to college. And I think that the issue is not so much about blaming the community, but really looking at institutional effectiveness. There have been studies that have looked at community college that found the majority of people who attend community college do not graduate. They do not transfer, even those who want to transfer and who start out on the transfer track. Yet, I know when I was in high school, I was told after I was admitted to Yale that I should go to the local community college. And my stepchildren are still being told in honors classes that if they don't get into a UC, they should go to a community college. I think we need to look at how can we make these institutions more effective and more accountable, as well as we have a huge capacity problem. We don't have enough capacity in the community colleges or in the California system to be able to admit people who are qualified and who want to go to school. So what can we do to improve institutional capacity, accountability, and effectiveness rather than saying the problem is with the group or alleged group values, which turn out to be only a stereotype?
Okay, that's a good point. All right. Michael Christ wants to answer that.
Yes, I think that's right on target. As I indicated, the aspirations and graduation rates of Latinos are going up. For a variety of reasons, including income, they need to go part-time. And they are, in many cases, then 78% going to community colleges who graduate from high school. These students do not know what the standards are in community colleges, meaning I've done in-depth studies on this. They think they're ready because they've passed a minimum high school graduation test, which is about at the ninth grade level, and they've completed the minimum high school graduation requirements. Nobody tells them that community colleges have virtually the same standards for transfer as the four-year schools. In fact, they are the same. And so they fail placement exams when they get in, and they start off in remedial courses, and they end up not getting strong services and dropping out at very, very high rates, probably 80% is my best estimate. Secondly, we spend overwhelmingly the money, high amounts on higher and four-year schools and not 2 years. Let me give you two numbers. The University of California undergraduate student gets about $20,000 in money spent by the state on that student. The California Community College student gets $4,500 spent. So these students who need the most get roughly a fifth of the UC expenditure.
All right, we'll take a call from Peggy in San Anselmo. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, my name's Peggy Dodge. I'm from San Anselmo. My question, actually comment, is I've been hearing you talk about the square pegs and round holes and a lot of emphasis on the need for increasing English competencies, but I think maybe we're missing the asset that we may have in our state with the population of people who can speak a language other than English. If you look around the world, you see that many of the countries have populations who are at least bilingual, sometimes even trilingual. And so what we're looking at in our country right now is the states that are doing well have large English-speaking populations. That might be great for right now for those states, but what about the future and the globalization of the economies?
That's a good
question.
All right, it's a good point, and it's also the subject of an email from Carolyn, who says it seems to me that children of immigrants have an advantage because they are forced to learn a second language, English, at an early age. Maybe Deborah Santiago can kind of talk about this. Does having the second language or the first language give you an advantage as well as a disadvantage?
Well, as someone who is bilingual, I think it does provide an advantage. But I've seen it cut both ways because the perception of what that means is that you have to, if you forego one language for another, then you've assimilated and you're a part of this culture. And we get into a lot of these ethnic wars where people, I guess, feel very defensive and think that if someone who does not speak English, who is an immigrant, does not quickly assimilate and change their language, that that's a negative. But I would defy anyone who would want to look and see in any state, especially California, there's always a wait list on those, especially adult education, those who want to learn English. And if we could turn it on its head and make it a positive so that we have students learning in a dual language environment, I think that as a country we would be much more competitive than we are today.
Interesting. Let me give out the phone number one more time. It's 866-733-6786. That's our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, if you want to join our discussion about the new Chance for Success Index, which talks about success in California and education.
Spencer?
Yes, who's that?
This is Deborah.
Deborah.
I'm sorry. Could I add one little thing to the comment that Michael had made about institutional effectiveness?
Go ahead.
Just quickly, one of the recommendations we have and what we've seen is that community colleges are funded by headcount, by how many students they enroll, and there isn't a lot of incentive for them and they're to make sure they transfer or get them to complete. So one of the ideas we have, again, a concrete policy option, is can we address that funding formula so that rather than just focusing on headcount, because you can enroll a new kid every semester and you're not getting him through, could we look at issues of incentive, providing incentives for community colleges to make sure they transfer or they graduate those students? So it's a positive incentive, but it gets us beyond enrolling.
I find it very interesting that this discussion has moved in the direction of community colleges and how important they are. I think that's something that I wouldn't have guessed. Let me just give you an email that Sandy wrote to us. The obvious thing is population. If you don't have a lot of family income, and that income is divided with each child, and yet a family elects to keep adding children and expects us taxpayers to help them make up the income problem, why is this a problem the taxpayers must fix? Please, folks, where is the logic and honesty in this discussion? And I'm going to see if Steve Levy can tackle that one.
Oh, thank you so much, Spencer. the writer has a common perception. It's rapidly becoming incorrect. The Latino fertility rates are dropping dramatically, so if that's what bothers your listener, she should be well informed that actually population growth in California is still going on, but it's dropping and the birth rates are dropping as people assimilate. It doesn't answer the question that these are our children and they are going to become our workforce. You can get mad at them. You can get mad at them because they're poor, because they speak Spanish, because some of them came here illegally. You can get mad if you want, but you can't change the fact that our economy and our middle class in the next 20 years is going to depend on our success in educating these children, just like it was for our children and our grandparents' children. Our children are our precious asset. Two quick points. Deborah said, and no one picked up on it, there are waiting lists in adult school for people to learn English. There are waiting lists in many community college programs for nursing and other training so that the parents can move up and provide greater income and greater English language skills, and maybe through the actions of the parents provide the children with some of the head start attributes that Christopher and Michael were talking about. I think we make a mistake if we focus only on the children and neglect our ability to influence the children's prospects through giving their parents better English, better jobs, better training. We need the parents to move up too.
Okay. Let's take another telephone call. Let's take a call from Lisa in Pengrove. Hi, Lisa. You're on forum.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have kind of it's a comment and a question. I am white. I have a 19-year-old daughter who graduated from high school last year. She went through standard California education, K-12. The girl can barely put a sentence together. Admittedly, she is not in any way scholarly. She hates to read. She has been tested, does not have any learning disabilities. I have my very best friend who's Latina. She has two kids, 19 and 16. The 19-year-old barely graduated from high school, has a very difficult time, putting a sentence together. And I'm reasonably certain that the 16-year-old is going to end up in the same situation. My friend and I both are what I assume would be considered middle class. I make $76,000 a year. She makes about $85,000 a year.
I should be happy to hear that you told everyone that.
Well, I didn't say who she was yet, did I? No names. But in any case, the challenge that I put to you, folks, is how could these kids, who are all three extremely bright in my assessment, have been lost and just sort of lost in the cracks?
Is your own daughter a single child?
Yes.
An only child?
Okay. An only child.
Okay, you know, you ask a question that would take us like all week or maybe longer to answer, but Michael Kirst has been teaching teachers for about 35 or 40 years, I think, and we're going to give him a shot at that.
Well, as she pointed out, they were high school graduates, and I also worked on the technical committee that put together the high school exit exam. And we were told that all the mathematics questions should be 6th through 8th grade level on the California standards, plus a little algebra. And the language arts standards for graduation are, for the state test called the high school exit exam, are 8th through 10th grade, though you only have to get 55% of them right. So schools generally keep passing students on if they show up and work and turn in enough work. And so they'll get a passing grade, and then they can pass this exit exam at a very low level, and they're out of high school with a ticket to nowhere in terms of higher education because they'll be in severe remediation at the community colleges.
Would you make the tests harder and flunk these kids out and say, no, you don't get to graduate? I mean, we're going on a tangent here, I know.
Yeah, but I know. Then that's a deep question because we have a significant percentage of students failing the high school exam as it exists now. So obviously you need to do more than just improve a test. But the Education Week report we're discussing shows that K-12's performance relative to other states in achievement is very poor among the bottom 10% of the states. So this is a tremendous weakness in California, and we need to really focus on this. It comes out loud and clear in this report.
Now, I want to go to Christopher Swanson and with the Editorial Projects and Education Research Center, the group that did this study. We've been talking mostly about how you do in school and then how you do in junior college or community college. But your report talked about family income, parents' education, parental employment, linguistic integration, preschool enrollment, kindergarten enrollment, and then some test scores from high school and whether you graduate from high school. How do all those things, are those extraneous or those key to this thing, or do we just have to essentially know that the schools aren't doing a good job? It seems like there's a lot of information here.
You know, there is, but I think we can boil it down in some pretty fundamental ways. I think all of these things are important, and the thing to make sure people are starting to talk about more, and I think we start to hear more about this recently, is that we can't think about education as just kind of what happens in the schoolhouse in isolation from what happens before, what happens after you go to school. So when we think about what happens in an early childhood situation, those foundations that they get in the home are essential. We know that kids who come from more disadvantaged backgrounds start out even kindergarten kind of way behind their more affluent peers, and they don't really catch up during the schooling years. And, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, you know, what are we preparing students to do? We heard a couple examples of, you know, the situation in California, and Mike and the caller both mentioned this. You know, we look at our data, we see that California performs low compared to the rest of the country, but it has a high college-going rate compared to the rest of the country. And this is a little bit of a disjunction. You know, we hear a lot in the higher education field about high remediation rates, kids coming to college not able to, you know, enroll in credit-bearing courses, so they take remedial courses, they fall behind, they're not accumulating credits, and they're not succeeding in college. And I think that is a very important issue, you know, alongside the capacity issues, you know, we mentioned before. And I think it is right that we think, especially in California, given the labor market and the demographics, that the two-year colleges may be an important part of the solution. And yet we even have capacity issues there. One of the things we look at
is capacity issues. They don't hold enough kids.
What I'm saying. So we looked at the numbers of seats, you know, first-time students in degree, you know, programs in the two-year and the four-year systems in each state. and we found that if you take just the people who finished high school, you could put 20 out of every 100 in a four-year college, you could put 21 out of every 100 in a two-year college. What happens to that other 60, kids where there's, not a spot for them? Now, unfortunately, not all of our high school graduates are going on to college, but it does speak to an important capacity issue that if what we do want to do is get a better educated adult workforce, and that might mean coming back to school after you've been out in the labor market for a while, it's a really tough issue, more so in California than and elsewhere in the country, to find the seats to put those students into.
Okay. We will take a call from Lori in Hayward. Hello, Lori, you're on forum.
Hi,
is it Lonnie?
Lonnie.
I'm sorry, it's
That's
Lori.
That's all right, no problem.
I'm
a community college faculty person counselor, and I just want to say that there are a couple of issues. One is if you help also students not focusing on ESL, but also focus on those who are not succeeding, which includes black students, that everybody benefits.
ESL is English as a second language.
Exactly,
yeah.
But there are many black students who are failing, and they're not ESL students. If you focus on the lowest performing students, everybody benefits, number one. Number two, the funding issues, which have been talked about, are nothing has been mention of the fact that our funding at community colleges is tied to K-12. It's K-16. There's currently legislation trying to be put into action through the community colleges on separating our funding from K-12. So if K-12 suffers money or there's a focus on it, our funding decreases. We are not treated equally at the collegiate level as the UCs and CSUs. And the third thing is one of the parents mentioned she was a single parent, and I am too, had two children, both of whom have disabilities. And the biggest issue is what you're doing outside of the classroom, which means parental involvement. I chose to put my children in private school for a number of reasons. They're both bright, read at the 12th grade level at 7 and 8 years old, yet they have this unfunded mandate disability of ADD. So I chose not to buy a home, not to do anything extra, and focus all my money on putting them in private schools the first 7 or 8 grades of their lives, and it worked. My son is graduating from the University of Arizona next year, and my daughter's doing very well. So my concern is that we not forget that it is parents, if you're going to leave your children in public schools, and many people do not have the option I had, you must stay vigilant, whether your children are disabled or not. You must be vigilant. And we have to separate our funding from K-12. I'll take my comments off.
Okay,
here. Thank you
very much. I just want to repeat a note that Michael Kirst did, told me when we were off the air for a minute, that the number of or the percentage of students in private school in California is not changing particularly. It's about 10%, and there isn't a huge exodus to the private schools. It's 10%, and that's 10%. Okay, I want to take a call from Orlando in San Jose. Good morning, Orlando. You're on forum.
I got a BS in biology from UCLA, and in that education, I did an undergrad class project looking for the main reasons Latinos don't go beyond high school education. And after talking to several friends and strangers about this, one of the outstanding reasons for why they didn't go on is due to the parental participation in the education during high school and previous years. And I just wanted to...
What do you mean? I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Parental participation in many ways informed, which is the way I talked to... which is the way that they brought up. Parental expectancies.
You mean the parents didn't participate? Is that what you're saying?
They were just there mentally for their children. That was one of the reasons.
It's interesting. I talked to a school superintendent in San Jose, a high school superintendent, and she was Latino or Latina, and she said to me that many of the Latina parents wanted their kids to stay close to home. And this was a deterrent in some cases about going to college. Does that ring a bell with you also?
Exactly. I actually went the other route. I was brought up in Madera, the Central Valley, but I actually went to UCLA. So my sister, she's in the same situation, the other situation. She's living at home and going to junior college just for the same reason that you just brought up right now.
Interesting. Deborah Santiago, you want to comment on that? Is that part of this equation?
Well, that's the main reason why Excelencia exists is to address those kinds of topics. And we find that it is, as most things, rather complex. But, parental involvement can mean more than just picking which institution they go to. We do find in general that Latino parents want their children to go, if they go to college, to go closer to home. And in part, it's expense. In part, it's that they don't know the alternatives or the qualitative difference between going to an MIT and going to an El Paso community college. Not to denigrate any community college, but they've been through a K-12 system where they've had very little choice. and often the parents have not gone to college themselves. And so what to differentiate going to, you know, continuing to the public school that's nearby, which would be the community college, versus something that's far away. Those of us who are educated know there's a qualitative difference in going to a more selective institution. But they see the sticker price, and they say you can pay $2,000 and go here, or you can pay $45,000 and go there. And, mijito, why would you go over there? We can't help you. We can't protect you.
All right. So we're running out of time. We've got a couple of minutes left. What I'd like to do is just do a quick round robin here. What is the bottom line? We've got a report. We see what it says. That there are a lot of factors involved in keeping California students, for example, in 34th place. Are we talking about adding money? Are we talking about influencing the governor? What do we want to do, Christopher Swanson? What would be make you very happy?
Oh, lots of things would make me happy, but I think for California, you know, there's a couple key messages. You know, we talked about California's 34th ranking, which is not great, but there are some bright signs, and California ends up doing better than other states that start out in a similar place demographically. If you look at New Mexico, which is a bottom-ranked state, it looks very similar in the early years. You know, there are signs of you know, brightness when you look at, you know, the performance of K-12 and some improvements in recent years, even though they're below average, and there's economic opportunities. What that suggests to me is that there's a real kind of early foundation issue in California that's probably more severe than in some other states. And this is probably, you mentioned the governor, this is probably not just an education system issue. And so while we want to think about the ways in which the schools can perform better and provide opportunities later in life, we need to make sure that we're taking care of the young kids and their families so they get to school, you know, better able to learn.
Right, we're never going to get through our round robin, but let's, Michael Kirst, quickly, I mean, you've seen reports like this sit on the shelves. What would be the one thing you would like to see as a result of this?
The future growth in California is overwhelmingly from the Latino population. It is not well educated at this point. We need much better programs for transitioning these kids to English and much stronger programs in community colleges to help them once they get there.
Thank you very much, Stephen Levy, director of the Stephen Levy is with us, director of the Center for Continuing Study of California Economy. You were just listening to Michael Kirst from Stanford, Deborah Santiago, vice president of policy and research at Excellencia in Education in Washington, and Christopher Swanson, editorial projects and education research center. This is Forum from KQED-FM. I'm Spencer Michaels. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.